With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here. Thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Purple limes stoke discussion on bioengineering. A new transgenic lime developed by scientists at USDA can dramatically change the tint of your next margarita. Ready for purple? The new purple lime is created by inserting the pigment gene from the blood orange into Mexican lime plants. USDA research geneticist Jim Thompson says the idea is to stir discussion over bioengineered products in hopes of gaining greater public acceptance. Bioengineering of citrus products is also seen as a potential guard against crop diseases, such as Wang Long Bing, also known as HLB. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into our show headlines. AFT says farmland loss impacts rural and urban alike. American Farmland Trust recently released a multi-year study that indicates that if changes are not made, up to 25 million acres of farmland will be lost across the U.S. by the year 2040. Andy Candib with AFT says their study looked at three different levels of urban sprawl and the impact it would have on the farming community. Business as usual will result in the loss of 18 million acres. Runaway sprawl will result in 25 million acres loss. Better built cities, an effort to limit urban sprawl, will result in roughly 11 million acres being lost. Candib noted the response from farmers, producers, and the boots on the ground is in line with the results nationwide.
One of the pieces that I'm most excited about with this research is it really makes this not just about an issue for rural and agricultural communities. One of the biggest takeaways from this research is that this is an issue that matters to all of us. This is an urban issue, and we need farmers coming to the table to help us advocate for greater urban density.
Candib says it's not realistic to expect 0 acres of farmland loss, but that does not mean the farming community should not speak up before it's too late. She added the expectation is that over 500,000 acres will be lost in the North Pacific West, with most of that coming around urban areas that are reporting rapid growth.
This loss is going to disproportionately impact our most productive, versatile land. And the other thing that will happen is that this loss also threatens the future for those small and peri-urban farms in particular. And one of the things we see is that for new and beginning farmers who are just starting out, they're often starting out on those smaller acreage parcels that are closer to cities.
And AFP contributed to that report. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more Ag News.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture has released its 2022 California Citrus Acreage Report. President and CEO of California Citrus Mutual, Casey Creamer, said the information provided by the industry through surveys shows that overall acreage has stayed largely the same over the past 2 years, but they are seeing some shifts in acreage of certain varieties.
For our purposes, we really look at the bearing acres, the acres that are in production and going to be producing fruit for the upcoming year. And that number stayed pretty static, you know, roughly a little bit more than 250,000 acres statewide from the last report 2 years ago. But some of the things that we're noticing in trends as growers, you know, take out a block and redevelop it is the shifts in varieties. And so the one variety that we knew was continuing to come on pretty strong was the Mandarin variety. That's now up to 63,000 acres. It was 59,000 just a couple of years ago, and there's more non-bearing acres that are still coming online. And so that Mandarin number is getting to a point where, you know, it's probably going to stabilize moving forward as that market kind of meets its potential.
Updates have been made to the plan for addressing glassy-winged sharpshooters found in Solano County. According to the California PD GWIS Board, the Solano County Agriculture Department extended the treatment area for the infestation in the Browns Valley neighborhood of Vacaville, but recent additional sharpshooter finds have not resulted in an expansion of the infested area. County officials are working with the Pierce's Disease Control Program to eradicate the infestation by conducting visual surveying, trapping, and insecticide treatments. Since April, nearly 2,000 parasitic wasps have also been released as a biological control effort to address the infestation. Approximately 95% of residential properties in the area have been treated between fall of last year and early 2022, with additional treatments taking place over the summer. The infestation in Solano County is the only current infestation north of the Madera area. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Argentina's government recently announced incentives for the country's farmers to sell more soybeans. In a bid to boost exports and hard currency reserves, farmers can get a better exchange rate for their soybeans. Dr. Michael Cordonnier, an agronomist with Soybean and Corn Advisors, Inc., says it will have a short-term impact in the country and on the world market.
This favorable exchange rate is good through the end of September. Currently, Argentine farmers are about 10% slow sellers compared to last year. They're going to sell after this exchange rate because it's like a gift for them. The exchange rate is 139 pesos to the dollar, but you're allowed to do soybeans now at 200 pesos to the dollar. So they are going to sell. And by the end of September, the Argentine farmer might be up to, say, normal sales, maybe a little bit ahead. But this program ends at the end of September. After that, it goes back to where it was before. When you get to October 1st, the farmers are going to stop selling again, or at least sell slower.
He says the move will put more Argentine soybeans into the world market and prices will likely drop, but the impact won't last long.
There's going to be like a flush of soybeans coming on and also meal and oil. Now, in Argentina, most of it's meal and oil that comes out. So the processors, like the Cargills of the world, they were running maybe 50 to 60% capacity in their crush facilities because they couldn't get the soybeans. Well, now they'll get it. So there'll be a little flush of soybeans and meal and oil for the next couple of weeks. But we're kind of back in the same situation to start October.
Argentina is the world's biggest soy, oil, and meal exporter and the third biggest soybean supplier. Cordonnier talks about why the government made this move.
First of all, the farmers are slow sellers because they were waiting for a devaluation. The official rate right now is 139 pesos per the dollar, but the black market rate is twice that. So the market was saying there must be a devaluation. So the farmers want to wait for the devaluation. Well, that didn't happen, but instead the government said, okay, we'll raise it up to 200 pesos to the dollar. So it's not a devaluation per se, but for the farmer, it's almost the same thing as a devaluation because they put more money in their pocket when they sell to the crushers in Argentina because the crushers are allowed to exchange their exports at the 200 peso rate versus 139. So it's a gift to them and they're passing on the gift to the farmer. But this is only temporary.
He also says the inflation rate in Argentina will likely hit 90% by the end of 2022. The U.S. says Russia has no grounds to scuttle the Black Sea grain deal that has now freed up shipments of more than 1 million tons of Ukrainian grain and food items and helped ease war-fueled inflation. Is Russia again trying to blackmail the West over sanctions, this time threatening the Black Sea grain deal? State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vinit Patel won't say, but dismisses Moscow's complaints to U.N. officials.
U.S. sanctions have always had clear exemptions for food and fertilizer, and our sanctions have never targeted humanitarian assistance. We want to see food and fertilizer reach global markets, and Russia must continue to live up to its commitments.
Russia's already cut off gas supplies to much of Europe and, in recent days, has stepped up its threats against the grain initiative brokered by Turkey and the UN.
I believe there were allegations that grain was not going to countries that needed it. That simply is not the case either. Because of this arrangement, grain has been able to reach global markets and gone to countries that need it desperately.
And that's not all.
And some of these other allegations that we've seen that, one, global food prices are rising just aren't the case. In fact, global food prices have fallen as a result of the Black Sea port arrangement.
But the joint monitor for the shipment says still high fuel and fertilizer prices are, quote, placing immense pressures on farmers and consumers, as well as millions who face poverty and hunger. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, for many dairy farmers in California, water is top of mind. And while efforts are being discussed, the state badly needs moisture in the next few months to stave off greater immediate hardship for producers. And this is the topic of a podcast released this week from the National Milk Producers Federation. Jeff Vandenhoevel, Director of Regulatory and Economic Affairs for the California-based Milk Producers Council, explains the water issues the dairy industry is seeing.
As overregulated as California is on everything, it never regulated its groundwater on a statewide basis. You know, a huge amount of the dairy industry in California is now in the Central Valley. 85 to 90% of the milk produced in California is produced in the Central Valley. It's a vast groundwater basin. Millions and millions of acre feet of water reside under the ground, and it was never regulated. Consequently, dairy siting, when the dairy industry came in a big way into the Central Valley, which was probably, 35 to 40 years ago. Of course, there's been dairy here for a lot longer than that, but it really took off. A huge amount of the increase in volume came from the Central Valley. Dairymen found large tracts of ground that were available, and as long as there was water underneath you, you could put wells in. California always depended on the Central Valley, a combination of groundwater and surface water. The surface water comes not so much in the local area, not a lot of rain in the California Central Valley, but there's a lot of rain and snow that occurs in the Sierra Nevada mountains, which is directly to the east of the Central Valley, and then up in the Cascades, which is more in the northern part of the state. And so major irrigation systems were built both by the federal and the state government, which brought those large supplemental supplies into the Central Valley. And then the Sierra Nevada watershed, the rivers that drained the Sierra Nevada from the east, most of those were developed by local water agencies, with the exception of a large federal project that was done in the 1950s. So for many years, it was a combination of surface water and groundwater that sustained agriculture in California and created really, what is an agriculture marvel in the world.
And Vandenhoevel knows it's not so much that way anymore.
It's a combination of droughts, but also what we call man-made drought. In the early 1990s, there were a couple of really critical policy decisions, regulatory decisions that were made that now, 30 years later, we can see kind of what the contribution that those changes made to the situation we're finding ourselves in. And there was a Central Valley Project Improvement Act that was passed in, I believe, 1991 or 1992. Which took about 800,000 to 1 million acre feet of Central Valley Project yield and dedicated it to the environment.
To hear the full podcast, go to the National Milk Producers Federation website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Today's show is sponsored by the makers of All Grow Compost, a natural, organic-based, all-in-one solution. Contact your soil health specialist, Tom Fantozzi, at 209-312-4016. Cinegrow, your partner for a cleaner, greener world. You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Many college agriculture teachers are former industry professionals that decided to share their knowledge and experiences with college students pursuing those same career paths. Some, however, are former high school agriculture teachers that have a passion for teaching adults and aiding with the next generation of agriculture teachers. I'm Brandon Black with today's episode of Ag to the Future. Charles Abey, a teacher at College of the Sequoias in Tulare, California, shared his agricultural teaching history and what led him to his current position in a recent interview. Here are clips from that discussion. Could you describe your transition from teaching high school agriculture to college agriculture and what the motivation was behind that transition?
I've had a lot of good mentors along the way, and it was a slow transition. So, my teaching career, kind of breaking it up, I started out after I got done student teaching. I taught at Woodlake High School for 2 years. And during that time, my fiance was going to UC Davis. And they ended up talking her into getting a PhD. So I was making the drive up to Davis, or she was making the drive down to Woodlake quite a bit. And we decided, what was best for, my personal life was for me to go up to Davis and kind of help support her while she was going through her graduate degree. So I taught at a little high school called Esparto High School up there. About 300 kids in the entire school. Had a really good experience up there. But while I was up there, I started teaching a night class at Woodland Community College. It was a night welding class, really kind of a small class. They actually, Woodland Community College used Pioneer High School's welding shop. So I really started kind of diving in and learning more about, you know, teaching adults. And then when I, you know, came, so my wife graduated and we came back down, actually started teaching at Woodlake High School again for a couple of years. And at that time, I, you know, one of my mentors, Ken Hoipel, was needing some help teaching a welding class at night up at Fresno State. So I, you know, I jumped on board and started doing that. It was, you know, a 5 o'clock p.m. to a 10 o'clock p.m. class one day a week, and, you know, helping, you know, those future ag teachers, you know, that welding class was either plant science students or ag ed students. And then from there, I had an opportunity. Frank Thibault, who was one of my teachers when I was here at COS, actually was my neighbor living in Lindsay. He came over one day and said, you know, Charlie, we have this teaching opportunity at COS. It's in plant science. And, you know, we really would like you to apply for it, you know, and at least consider it. So, you know, at that time, I had been thinking, you know, it would be nice to wind up at the college level, not because I didn't like the high school level, but because, you know, it challenged me more, right? And I like to challenge myself and try to become better at what I'm doing. So, yeah, I applied and, you know, I was offered the position and took it. You know, I had some farming background and, you know, kind of dived in and tapped into some of my plant science resources, and I taught plant science here for a year. And then there was an ag technology mechanized ag position that opened up, and I thought, you know what, I'm gonna apply for that. And it was kind of a weird, like, lateral movement over. I still had to interview and, you know, reapply and re-interview and all that stuff, and, you know, was offered the position, and then that opened up the plant science position again. So really, you know, from there, I've had to build like our irrigation program from the ground up. We had a basic water management class. And with, you know, what I see here locally in Tulare County, us being, you know, one of the heavily overdrafted ground water basins, you know, we thought, hey, what a better opportunity than now to start, you know, an irrigation program to really help train people that, you know, may not necessarily have, you know, the understanding of just some basic nuts and bolts in water management. So, so yeah, that's probably a long-winded answer, but
it started back in 2009 with Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack opening on the USDA grounds what he called the People's Garden, named for what Abraham Lincoln called the USDA, the People's Department. Vilsack says the People's Garden idea is not just to produce food, but to donate it to those who need it and also provide education to visitors about agriculture.
And hopefully they go back home and say, you know, geez, if they could do this with a corner lot in Washington, D.C. on the mall, maybe we could do it with that vacant lot down near the school. And so what we're anxious to do is to see an expansion of this People's Garden effort.
There are People's Gardens in 17 cities, but now Vilsack's offering the chance for organizations anywhere in the U.S. to have eligible gardens recognized officially as People's Gardens. For more information, go online to usda.gov/People's Garden. usda.gov/People's Garden.
And it's going to be an exciting opportunity to see the expansion of this idea all over the country.
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion,
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Helping households get high-speed internet. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. USDA is accepting applications for the ReConnect program loans and grants to help expand access to high-speed internet. The agency is making over $1 billion available for the program, a critical piece of the effort to connect every American to affordable and reliable high-speed internet. Congress approved $65 billion for broadband nationally as part of the Infrastructure and Jobs Act. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says broadband is critical for rural homes, hospitals, schools, libraries, businesses, and farmers, but not just any broadband.
The goal isn't just to have internet. The goal is to have high-speed internet. And that's the beauty of this infrastructure bill, this bipartisan infrastructure bill, because it provides the Department of Agriculture additional resources to address that issue.
The application deadline is November 2nd. You can go to rd.usda.gov for more information. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. The current high prices of farmland are making some farmers think about selling. While a land sale transaction can be straightforward, if some of the land is in the CRP or has buildings, drainage tile, or irrigation equipment on it, the tax issues can get complicated. If you sell farmland that is in the CRP and the buyer doesn't agree to keep the land in the program, you must repay all of the CRP payments plus interest. That's harsh, but you do get to increase your basis in the land by the amount repaid. Also, if you have grain bins, drainage tile, irrigation equipment, or similar assets that are sold with the land, you'll get taxed at your ordinary income tax rate up to the depreciation you have taken on those assets. One option might be to sell the land over time using a self-canceling note. This might work well if you want to sell the land to your children. Structure the note so the kids buy the land at fair market value and pay over a period of years. If you die before the note is paid off, the principal balance will be included in your estate and will be forgiven. But the value of the land is what it was when the note sale was entered into. Another option might be to structure the transaction as a tax-free exchange. With proper planning, you might be able to minimize your tax bill when you sell farmland. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Thanks, Roger. And what might be the purpose behind specialty crop block grants? Well, USDA's latest awards of those specialty crop block grants demonstrates the intent and benefit of this support to various aspects of the specialty crop industry. Here's USDA's Rod Bain with more.
Marketing, education, research, competitiveness. The intent of the Agriculture Department's specialty crop block grants.
Specialty crops are things like fruits, vegetables, tree nuts, medicinal plants, and nursery floriculture and horticulture crops. The specialty crop block grant program was established in the Farm Bill back in 2004. And since 2006, USDA has invested more than $950 million through this program to fund over 11,000 projects nationwide.
And Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs Jenny Moffitt says for the latest round of specialty crop block grant awards recently announced, the numbers come in at
$72.9 million in funding this year. So that is funding for over 600 projects across states, territories, and the District of Columbia.
Some of the projects awarded grants for this fiscal year demonstrate the wide range of use and focus within the specialty crop industry.
Everything from enhancing food safety to investing in specialty crop research, looking at pollinator habitat to enhance specialty crops, developing new seed varieties, conservation and environmental outcomes related to specialty crops, improved strategies for pest management and disease control, to also looking at the marketing campaigns, high quality digital marketing campaigns, developing the next generation of specialty crop producers as well.
The Undersecretary says more details about USDA's specialty crop block grant program can be found online at www.ams.usda.gov.
It's such an important tool for specialty crop producers to really identify research, identify education, identify marketing, identify production practices so that we are helping and supporting producers and the whole supply chain.
In addition to the recent specialty crop block grant awards, USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture also announced 21 projects will receive $74 million in grant funding under the Specialty Crop Research Initiative. These projects address critical issues in the specialty crop industry. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
And in more agriculture news, inflation has everyone paying higher prices. From groceries to gas and farm machinery, the impact of inflation is widespread. Michael Klimitz has more in this next report.
As the November election nears, voters over 50 hold the biggest say regarding who will win individual races. AARP Oklahoma State Director Sean Voskel says they have several issues in mind.
A recent poll from AARP shows these voters are concerned about inflation, the economy, Social Security, Medicare, and taxes. Prescription drug prices and the cost of hearing aids are also another concern. The Inflation Reduction Act does include cuts to Medicare drug prices starting in 2023 with a cap on co-pays of $35 for insulin, free vaccines, followed by a $2,000 out-of-pocket cap on medications in 2025, and Medicare price negotiations will take effect in 2026.
For seniors, some inflation relief could be coming through Social Security next year.
Many experts predict that the cost of living adjustment for Social Security benefits in 2023 could exceed 9%, likely one of the highest cost of living adjustments in history. Yet there's still great concerns regarding the economy in the future.
Concerns are rising that the Federal Reserve's monetary campaign to bring inflation down will push the economy into a recession.
The end of the economic expansion has been prematurely announced too many times recently. That said, the risk is real. So from a personal finance perspective, the key question is where your greatest risks are if the economy does stumble. Meanwhile, the housing market has been on a tear starting early in the pandemic, but is cooling off with higher interest rates. Still, the problem remains a lack of supply, even in many rural counties. How to think about your home and home equity in retirement is another good consideration.
Learn more Thursday night at 9 p.m. Central Time on RFD TV or online at aarp.org/AARP Live. Michael Klimitz reporting.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. This week's Voices of the Valley episode is our interview segment, and it's part two of the series honoring the life of Hank Gicklis and the impact he had on the industry and those around him.
Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you by Reedley College, educating the next generation of agriculturalists in advanced technology, efficient production practices, and food safety. Now here's your hosts of Voices of the Valley, Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson.
This is Dennis Donahue, and we're back again with Voices of the Valley with my good friend Candace Wilson, but a different type of episode. Candace and I had the privilege of knowing a pretty special person, Hank Gicklis, who was our Senior Vice President of Science and Technology for a number of years. And unfortunately, he passed away recently, unexpectedly, and Candace and I were chatting about it. And we just thought he was a very, very special person. And in fact, Dave Pouliot, at some point, I really love the phrase he came up with when he was letting us know in the Western Growers family that he had never known anyone with a bigger heart and a softer soul than Hank. And so that's the type of person he was. But he was also important to the industry and to a lot of people, and really accompanied the Western growers world the past couple of decades in a lot of key moments. So we thought it was a life worth remembering. Candace, did I get that right?
I think you summarized it beautifully, and I'm looking forward to hearing from the next series of guests.
Well, you know, for Hank, I wanted to try hard. So, so joining us right now is somebody who worked very, very closely with Hank a few years ago and on an ongoing basis is a good friend of Western Growers, Joe Pizzini, who worked with Hank while he was running Ocean Mist and the president or the chair of the Central California Growers Shipper Association, and now with Taylor Farms. Joe, thanks for taking the time for joining us. I was particularly pleased that you agreed to do this because I know you had a good, close working relationship with Hank, and I'd love for you to just kind of share your observations about Hank, type of person he was, the things you were working on, and what he meant to the industry.
Well, thanks, Dennis, and I appreciate it, and Candace, for being here today and being asked to do this. It's an honor. Hank was a wonderful guy. And you're going to hear that from a lot of different people. And certainly he was an unsung hero of the industry. I got to know Hank in a real pivotal time in the produce industry right after the 2006 spinach food safety outbreak. And as you mentioned, Dennis, I was the chair of the local grower shipper association. And we're kind of at a ground zero of that whole investigation and the stop of the industry all around illnesses related to spinach. But how I got to know Hank was we worked together on trying to create metrics, come up with standards for what eventually became the California Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement. So this was an audit program that we felt would lift the bar on food safety and provide a standard that we could all live by that would make a difference in food safety for produce. And so Hank, he was really instrumental in helping guide us. And, you know, kind of talking through the different options with standards and metrics, and they were controversial. And this was a pressure cooker time. There was no doubt about it. A real heightened awareness of what was going on in the industry around food safety at the time. But Hank, he introduced me to the whole concept of a construct. I didn't know what that was. And certainly putting a straw man together. So all this around putting forth a kind of a proposition, if you will, that we could all work off of and develop and really work through a process to create standards and metrics. And we did this in a number of different cases. And then Hank kind of carried the ball with the industry through Western Growers, of course, in proposing these standards, because the LGMA doesn't create the standards. It accepts those quality standards, in this case, food safety standards from the industry. So Hank was really instrumental in really carrying the water, doing the heavy lifting on helping us develop standards. I mean, we sat for hours talking about water quality, buffer zones, you know, the mode of potential contamination and mitigating measures that we could take and risk assessment. I mean, Hank was, he was an authority on all this. And if he didn't know the answer, he knew where to look to help find it. I mean, it was some really heavy lifting. And like I said earlier, he didn't want any credit for it. He was there at the benefit of the industry. And this was a time, a really pivotal time of the industry, kind of a reflection point around food safety and the future of produce.
You know, I like what you said. He didn't want any credit. And looking back at that time, because I think most people, particularly in the Salinas Valley, remember that era. And when you think about it, one, it was amazing how, relatively speaking, that fast that all came together. And you think about, I mean, I certainly think about your role. I know A.G. Kawamura was involved. But, you know, Hank really sounds like he was really the quiet man behind all this, the, you know, kind of the glue that kept everything together.
It's funny because Hank's a real big, tall guy and, you know, you're not going to miss him in a crowd. But he was able to work behind the scenes largely, which was kind of ironic in that respect. But he was kind of the glue to help us through a process that none of us had ever worked on before. We don't own audit programs. This isn't something that we do on a routine basis. And yet here we are as industry representatives trying to create something that was practical, that would make a difference, that we could live by and we could implement and get compliance from largely everyone in the industry at that time in California. So it was no small undertaking. And yet Hank was kind of the technical expert, the science behind what we were trying to accomplish. But really to be carrying the water with Western growers in the industry to put these standards, these metrics forward to help us create a cohesive program that's still ongoing today. And it has made a big difference.
One of the things that I always appreciated about Hank was, you know, watching him and the different committees at Western Growers. It was never about his personal agenda. It was about what's best for the industry and what is the board looking for and the committee members. Can you give some other examples of when you're working with him and how his ability to just stay focused on the task at hand and be just a really a good representative to not the industry, just his selflessness?
Well, you really have to look at kind of painting the picture of the times. And you had a lot of influences, we're talking political, we're talking industry-wide. And honestly, agriculture is really fragmented by commodity, by size, by growing methods, by geography. I mean, you name it. But Hank was able to kind of look around the room, listen to what people were saying, and pull all these threads together to weave something that we could all work with. You know, and that's where the construct comes in. That's where that whole idea of putting a straw man out there. And he had a unique ability of listening to all the divergent groups. I mean, they were all over the board at the time, probably still are today. But he was able to help weave all the different interests, all the threads together. And he would do it in a really quiet, concerted way. And he didn't have an agenda. He was just looking out for the best of the industry.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. The GAO reviews the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program. During 2020 and 2021, the USDA's Farm Service Agency provided $31 billion in aid to more than 950,000 producers of agricultural commodities, including crops, dairy, and livestock. The goal was to help offset losses and costs associated with COVID-19. The Government Accountability Office found problems in the process the FSA used to renew claims under CFAP submitted by producers. For example, the agency reviewed the claims of 90 producers, and over half didn't provide support for their payments. GAO says $661.5 million distributed primarily for livestock and other commodities went to high-income producers whose average annual adjusted gross income exceeded $900,000 over 3 years. The average payment per producer was highest in California at over $97,600. Iowa, California, and Nebraska each received over $2 billion in CFAP payments. 8 other states, including Minnesota, Kansas, and South Dakota, received at least $1 billion. And 7 individual operations received at least $3 million in payments. NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's Brian German with more Ag News.
This fall, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will be mailing the 2022 Census of Agriculture to millions of farmers and ranchers across the country. Ag producers will soon have the opportunity to be represented in the nation's only comprehensive and impartial agriculture data for every state, county, and territory. The 2022 Census of Agriculture will be mailed in phases, starting with an invitation to respond online in November, followed by paper questionnaires in December. Farming operations of all sizes, both urban and rural, which produced and sold or normally would have sold $1,000 or more of agricultural product this year, are included in the census. Conducted every 5 years by USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, the Ag Census tells the story and shows the value of U.S. agriculture. Changes to this year's questionnaire include new questions about the use of precision agriculture, hemp production, and updates to internet access questions. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian. And rounding out today's show, finding a clearer definition of product of the U.S. label. Here's Rod Bain with a report.
In the context of farm-produced commodities, both crops and meat animals, what does the term product of the U.S. mean?
Does it mean that everything that was done with reference to that product was done in the U.S., or does it mean animals born but raised someplace else and processed someplace else than the U.S.?
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, speaking with National Farmers Union representatives Monday, noted USDA efforts to better define the term includes a recent survey
of 4,000 consumers. And we asked the question, what do you think this means? And the second question, do you put value on it? It's one thing if you know what it means. Would you be willing to pay a nickel more because of the label?
The secretary says survey results will help determine how USDA can strengthen the direction and criteria of use of a product of the U.S. label.
Because once we do that, then we're in a position to essentially utilize the power we have at USDA to avoid misrepresentation or false statements.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.